From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lorenzo Carcaterra grew up in a neighborhood where lots of the men beat their wives and kids. So Lorenzo and his mother weren't the only ones. But when Lorenzo was 14, he found out the family secret. His father was a murderer. He killed his first wife. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Lorenzo Carcaterra about his new memoir. Also today, the controversial former director of America's premier art museum. We talk with Thomas Hoving about running the Metropolitan Museum of Art. His goal was to blow the dust off the museum, but he was criticized for being a schlockmeister. And Maureen Carrigan considers who isn't but should be performing at the inauguration. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations has rejected Iraq's conditions for allowing UN weapons inspectors to fly their own planes into Iraqi territory. Iraq said today that it would allow such flights, but that it would not be responsible for the safety of the UN inspectors. Spokesman Tim Trevon referred to a translation of Iraq's Arabic language statement. The statement seemed to say that Iraq would not be responsible for any accidental attacks on UN planes by Iraqi anti-aircraft or for any attacks by Allied warplanes patrolling the two Iraqi no-fly zones. Trevon said that Iraq has abdicated its responsibility to ensure the safety of UN personnel. He said the UN is sending Iraq a new set of flight plans in the hopes that they will not include the same conditions. In Little Rock, Arkansas today, President-elect Bill Clinton is working on his inaugural address and getting ready to leave for Washington tomorrow. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton is studying past inaugural speeches as he prepares to give his own. He's mentioned Lincoln's second inaugural as one of his favorites, the speech that said the most in the shortest amount of time, as Clinton puts it. Today, Clinton's spokesman, George Stephanopoulos, was asked again about Clinton's backing off from so many of his campaign pledges. Stephanopoulos acknowledged there'd been some bumps in the road during the transition, but cautioned reporters and the public not to rush to judgment about Clinton keeping his word. Stephanopoulos said, "Judge him by his performance. He will follow through on his commitments." Clinton and his aides have justified backing off from such campaign commitments as a middle-class tax cut and a promise to halve the deficit within 4 years by saying that circumstances have changed since Election Day. And sometimes they say things take longer to achieve. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
The U.S. Coast Guard has announced plans to discourage an exodus from Haiti by markedly increasing air and sea patrols around the island. From Miami, Doug Phillips reports.
The strategy is to use Coast Guard cutters, Navy ships, and aircraft to intercept refugee boats shortly after they leave Haiti. Coast Guard Commandant Admiral William Kime says Operation Able Manner isn't a blockade, but rather a humanitarian effort to keep Haitians from attempting a perilous 600-mile voyage.
I've directed that the Coast Guard deploy significant resources in an effort to prevent the possibility of major loss of life should a surge of Haitian migrants occur.
Coast Guard surveillance indicates some 1,500 Haitian boats are poised for possible trips to the U.S., but officials here hope the Coast Guard action and Bill Clinton's plan to continue the forced repatriation of Haitians will discourage most would-be refugees. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
Stock prices closed only slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 3 points to close at 3,271. This is NPR. A judge has blocked Colorado's anti-gay rights amendment from taking effect while a court challenge is heard. Denver District Judge Jeffrey Bayless said there's a good chance the law, which had been set to take effect today, will be found unconstitutional. Colorado voters approved the amendment in November. It prohibits the state and local governments from passing laws that protect homosexuals against discrimination and voids gay protection ordinances in Boulder, Aspen, and Denver. Italian police have arrested Salvatore Reina, the country's most wanted mafia boss. Reina is believed to be the head of the mafia's ruling council. Francis Kennedy reports.
62-year-old Reina was arrested by a special anti-mafia squad in Palermo after 23 years on the run. Unarmed but carrying false documents, he surrendered without a struggle. Reina was condemned to life in absentia in 1987. He's believed to have ordered the murders of judges Giovanni Falcone and Paolo Borsellino, whose deaths last year caused an international outcry and led to a sweep of arrests of mafia members. Since his Corleonese clan emerged victorious from the mafia wars of the 1980s, Raina is said to have ruled the organization with an iron hand. His arrest follows the revelations of former mafia members now cooperating with Italian judges and police. I'm Frances Kennedy for National Public Radio in Rome.
The leaders of 14 Somali factions agreed to a general ceasefire today in Addis Ababa, but it's not clear how long it'll take for them to get the word to their fighters. Most of Somalia's telecommunications have been knocked out during the years of civil war. Academy Award-winning lyricist Sammy Kahn died today at a Los Angeles hospital. He was 79. Kahn wrote hundreds of popular songs. His best-known works include Let It Snow, Love and Marriage, and Call Me Irresponsible. He wrote songs for many popular movies and the Broadway stage. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest was 14 years old when he found out that his father was a murderer. He killed his first wife. That revelation is at the center of Lorenzo Carcaterra's new memoir, A Safe Place. Lorenzo is managing editor of the TV series Top Cops and a former reporter for the New York Daily News. He grew up in a tough Manhattan neighborhood known as Hell's Kitchen. His father was a violent man with a raging temper. He frequently beat Lorenzo and his mother. It wasn't until a 1969 trip to Italy that Lorenzo's mother finally told him the family secret. He and his mother were visiting her family. They were far away from Lorenzo's father, who was home in New York. After Lorenzo's mother told him the story of the murder, she left him alone with his thoughts. I asked him if he was shocked.
He was no different, my father, than any of the other men I knew from the neighborhood we lived in. Beatings both to children and to wives were what they did. You know, it was how they solved, how they dealt with imminent problems. And so he didn't seem all that unusual. You know, and then you look back, you were told that, A, he's a murderer, so then you piece back things in the past and you start to see that all it would take for him to get to that point is just to push the envelope a little bit further, to keep the fuse lit a few minutes longer. And so then things started to make, to become clearer in my head about him.
Well, when you came home, when you got back to New York with your mother, and he beat your mother again.
All right.
Did it go through your mind, well, maybe this time he's going to kill her?
Well, I thought that to the day he died or to the day he could no longer function while he was in the hospital. But I'm always amazed to this day that he never did. And it wasn't a question that, you know, he loved wife number two more than he loved wife number one. In fact, I think he loved his first wife more than he loved my mom. But there was something that held him back. And it could be anything. It could be having killed someone once, he knew how far he had gone and held back. But something held him back. But it's one of the major surprises of my life that he actually never did kill her.
Why did he kill his first wife? I mean, it wasn't like he beat her and beat her and he didn't realize how much he was hurting her and
no,
he beat her to death. He intentionally smothered her
right.
by putting a pillow over
right.
her face in a hotel room.
Yeah, it was called a crime of passion. It was they had separated. They had been married 6 years. And in that period, it was a very stormy 6 years. They were very passionate when they were together. And then they had these outbursts where they would separate for months or weeks at a time. This was, I believe, the third such separation. And they've been negotiating. It was almost like a negotiation to get back together. And it seemed like they were on the right path towards another reconciliation. So he left that morning for the hotel where his wife was staying at with the full intent that this would be the final discussion and then they would be back together again as a family. In the hotel room, she apparently told him that the reconciliation was not possible because she was in love with another man. And this set him off. I mean, he was a violent man, B, he was an incredibly jealous man. And he just went into a rage in that room and put a pillow over her face and killed her.
Did you tell your father that you knew?
Not at 14. I didn't tell my father for 8 years after that. For a number of years, it was an unspoken understanding, it seemed to me, between the two of us. I think he knew I knew. I thought he knew that I knew. You know, so it was all that kind of situation. But we never openly spoke about it. And because I simply felt that I needed to know more about the situation than just the one sentence that my mother had told me. When I got back from Italy that summer, I went to the high school library, and I pulled on microfiche, the New York Times, and I found a clipping from November 1, 1946 that, in a couple of paragraphs, talked about my father's arrest. And so that sort of started me. I would talk to a lot of people, both friends and family, but given the nature of the situation where people had for years not talked about this, you couldn't directly ask them. So you had to sort of work around corners and ask indirect questions that would someday, over periods of years and periods of answers, get you to where you wanted to get to. So that took a long time.
And when you did finally tell your father, what did you say? What did he say?
Well, it wasn't like I woke up that morning and said, today, I'm going to talk to Dad about it. But he was having a fight with my mother. I was 22, and just to cool him down, we went and I dragged him to my car for a ride, and we were on the Long Island Expressway. He said one thing, I said another thing, and I just sort of blurted it out about his wife. And he slapped me and asked me never to speak about it again. And we did not speak about it again after that time until he was in the last months of his life at the hospital in St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in Manhattan, where we spent a lot of time and a lot of hours talking about it.
What kinds of things did you say to each other?
Those last 5 months, he was always curious as to why I wanted to know. I really didn't have a detailed explanation as to why I wanted to know. I just felt it was important to me. It was a part of his life, and since he was my father, it was a part of my life. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about, he very much, in those 5 months, very, very carefully and slowly, because he was very ill, took me from day one of that marriage, practically, to the final day of that marriage. And that was what I needed. That's what I really wanted from him all those years. And he was more than open about it.
When you found out that your father murdered his first wife, did you feel more responsible about protecting your mother against your father's beatings?
Yes, I think so. I think that's one of the reasons I stayed at home till practically my mid-20s, when most guys were getting their own apartment at 18. I was always concerned about it. I mean, he was very physical towards her. He thought nothing. To him, it wasn't even an argument just to simply slap her. That was sort of, if she asked a question that was inappropriate. So I was very concerned, and she's not a big woman. She's a very, like most Italian mothers, she's about 5'1", and a very quiet woman. So I stayed around longer probably than I should have for my own benefit, but I stayed around for what I thought were valid reasons.
There's a passage from the book I'm going to ask you to read in which you describe how you finally left home. And your father had brutally beaten your mother. Then he was beating you. You took out a knife and what you were considering using it?
Briefly, yes, yes. It was a pretty intense scene. And
do you want to set it up, set up the scene before you do the reading?
It was just one final confrontation in a series of violent confrontations. I mean, I just felt that these were feelings that I had throughout, but it just came to a boiling point that one of us had to either die or leave, and that it just couldn't go on anymore.
Your father had a knife. He dropped it.
Right.
Okay, and that... Why don't you read the passage for us?
Okay. "Come on, One Punch," my father said. "Stand up for yourself. Be like your old man. I killed. So can you." I took a step toward him, the knife at my side, wiping at thin streams of blood with the back of one hand. Outside, I heard loud knocking on our front door. "That's it," my father said. "Get even. That's what you want. Here's your chance. Won't take much. One shove, fast, in and out. You can do it. I know you can." We stared at each other for the longest time, both of us breathing hard, our bodies covered in sweat. Our hands were clenched. One of mine was still wrapped around a knife. "What's it gonna be, One Punch?" my father said. "I ain't got all day." I tossed the knife back to the floor. "You're not worth it," I said. "I know," my father said. He put a hand towel under the cold water faucet, wadded it up, and tossed it to me. "Clean yourself up," he said. "You got blood all over your face." He lifted my mother to her feet and helped her onto a chair. He then bent down, picked up the knife, and held it in his hand for a few seconds. He turned around and threw it into the kitchen sink. "I can't stay here anymore," I said to both my parents. "I just can't." "Then don't," my father said. "Don't worry about us. We'll be fine." I bent down and kissed my mother on the cheek and walked by my father, nodding at him as I passed. "Hey, One Punch," my father said. "You were right about one thing." "What?" I said, turning back to him, one arm inside the sleeve of a denim jacket. "You'll never be a murderer," my father said. "Never. It ain't in you. Now you can rest easy. You're not going to be like your father. To hell what everybody else may tell you. You and me, we know the truth." I nodded and walked out of the apartment and far away from the only life I had ever known.
Were you worried about that? Were you worried that you had the potential of being a murderer yourself?
Yes. I thought about it for a—well, I think the thing that I know, because of the upbringing I had and the family I have and had, that I'm capable of it, that my father did it, and I'm capable of it. I do know we're all capable of it. The only thing is I'm comfortable with the knowledge that we can do it. We are capable of killing someone, each of us. And for a number of years, that it was a fear inside of me rather than just a knowledgeable, just a fact. It was more fear than fact. I was afraid to have children for a number of years. I was afraid to get too involved with someone who may want to marry. But now it's just a realization that it's a fact which exists, that any one of us at any given time can take someone's life. My father just happened to have been one of those people who did do that. And I'm well aware of the violence that's inherent in all of us.
When you had your hands on a knife during that fight with your father, did you ever seriously consider stabbing him?
Oh, yeah. And it wasn't a long thought. It was for a few seconds. But, yeah, I could have seen myself do that, sure.
And what stopped you?
Well, my mother was there, for one thing. And two, you know, maybe I'm not as tough as I thought, or maybe I'm not as violent as I imagined.
Your father was really egging you on. I mean, he'd beaten your mother.
Yeah.
He'd beaten you. He was saying, "Come on, just do it."
Yeah.
But,
I think he wanted to see if, you know, what I had in me, whether I was capable of doing it to him at that moment.
You think in some sick way he would have been proud of you if you stabbed him?
No. I think he was proud of me that I didn't.
Uh-huh.
Because that, you know, I think in his own way he probably thought about it too, that whether I was capable or whether I was going to kill somebody. And this proved to him. I mean, he rested easy after that.
Uh-huh.
And also, the times we saw each other after that were not violent ones.
My guest is Lorenzo Carcaterra. He's written a new memoir called A Safe Place, The True Story of a Father, a Son, a Murder. And it's the story of his father, how his father beat his mother, and how his father murdered his first wife. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Lorenzo Carcaterra. He's written a new memoir called A Safe Place, which is the story about his father and how Lorenzo learned that his father actually killed his first wife. When you walked out on your parents and you just, after that fight, you decided to just leave home,
mm-hmm.
What did you think would happen when you left? I don't mean just that night, but...
In general?
Yeah. Leaving them to each other the way you did.
I thought what would happen is what did happen, and luckily, that they would eventually move back to Italy. They were living then in the Bronx, in an area that was sort of starting to fall apart, and my mother had apartments in Italy, and they could have a better life. They did move back there, and while the con games my father pulled continued, they were of a much more limited scope, and while the beatings continued, because she was there surrounded by her own family, they were very limited in number. So I thought she'd be safer there. And in order for her to get there, I had to leave. And it dawned on me, you know, probably a couple years later than it should have, that that's what would have happened. And that's what in turn did happen.
You'd advised your mother when you were in your 20s that she should just get away from your father,
yeah.
that she should go to Italy herself,
right.
go back to her family and get away from him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that made a lot of sense to you. Why wouldn't she do that?
Well, she's of a generation. She's cut from a different cloth. I mean, they're just women like my mother play the card that's dealt. And the card that's dealt is if you're happily married, you're married to a terrific man, that's the card. If you're married to somebody who beats you and abuses you and doesn't work and rifles up debts, that's the card. But whatever, regardless of what color the card is, you stay. You don't leave.
Do you think your parents loved each other?
Yeah, I do. I do. There were times when I thought I was the one that was insane. I mean, they'd have a fight at 5:30, 6 o'clock that seemed like Ali Frazier, where things were breaking and things. And then at 8 o'clock or whenever it was, 8:30, they'd be in the living room hugging and kissing, laughing and watching Perry Como. So I'd sit in the kitchen and say, you know, it's got to be me. It's got to be. I got to be the one that's nuts because look at them, you know. And anybody who walked in from the outside and saw them, as people have. I mean, people told me who've read the book said, you know, I'm really surprised. I always saw them together and they were always laughing and giggling like newlyweds. There was a genuine, they grew to love each other. I don't think when they married they loved each other very much. But I think they grew to love one another and care about one another. I mean, I would watch my mother care for him in his last weeks as if they had, an Ozzie and Harriet relationship throughout the 35 years. I mean, you would not know. The nurses at the hospital always commented to me about how close they were. And I think they were very close. It's just... the nature of my father's personality was a violent one, that he solved the slightest problem with a fist. But my mother, I think, understood that about him towards the end.
Did you grow up thinking this was normal, that, you know, you get married, you beat your wife, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for a lot of years. I mean, I didn't know any woman up until I went to Italy. I didn't know any woman who had not at least who had not been beaten at least once or twice by her husband in any given year. Our next door neighbor was always in some sort of bandage. The woman who lived next door to us, and her husband was in a wheelchair and he beat her. So I mean, I never met any housewife, and that's all they were. None of them were working women. They were all housewives, who did not get beaten. So I began to think this was you met somebody from the neighborhood, you married, and 6 months later you beat her up. But luckily I found out otherwise.
Your father wanted you to be tough.
Yeah.
His nickname for you was One Punch.
Right.
Did you want to be tough too?
I think all the kids at Hell's Kitchen thought they were tough, so we all thought we were tough. But whether I was or not, I don't know. I didn't enjoy being tough. I mean, the playing the street swagger that you had to play in those neighborhoods. I was much happier sneaking into the library next door and reading some Jack London. But you had to play the game of tough. I wasn't very comfortable with it, never was, and in truth wasn't very good at it.
You know a story that I find just particularly interesting in the book. It's a story of how you took your lover, who I guess she was about to become your fiance, to meet your father, and your father did this great performance.
Yeah.
He was saying to her, "Oh, my son told me you were attractive. He didn't say you were beautiful."
Right,
and he went on and talked about like what a
terrific lady she was.
Yeah, well, how great marriage was, and how much he loved your mother. And
well, I tell you, my father could be here on this show today.
Yeah,
and I'd let him speak for a lot of time. And at the end of the show, you, as well as some of your listeners, would say, "This guy is fantastic. What a great guy. I wish I had a father just like him." And he knew how to charm people. He was a great storyteller. He was a kind of terrific at parties. And people always, you know, I'd have a fight with him on a Saturday night. And then Sunday, people would call and say, "Oh, I met your father at a party, man. What a great guy." And you'd just want to eat the phone. but, yeah, he had that knack. He was really good with women, especially, and just smooth talked. My mother-in-law met him briefly. And, I mean, he hit on her. So it was...
You're kidding.
No. So it was, you know, he heard she was a widow. She's the doctor's widow, and she was very attractive. And, you know, he was telling her how beautiful she looked, how he had never met a woman from Ohio, and how they all so beautiful in Ohio. And
have you gotten offers to make this story into a movie?
They're talking about it now. I don't know anything specific yet, but, you know, they're talking about it.
It's funny, you know, you describe how when your father was in the hospital, he thought this would be a good way to make a lot of dough, you know, if he told you his story that somebody would want
to buy
the book or make the movie.
Yeah. This for him, this is the ultimate con. And that's I mean, this is like getting money to tell people everything you did in your life. I think, in a way, I'm sorry that he's, in many ways, I'm sorry he's not alive. But one of the main reasons, he'd be on the book tour. I mean, save me some travel time. He definitely would be having a great time.
That's too weird to think about.
Yeah, but he'd be a great guest.
But, you know, I'll be honest with you, and I've said this before, you never know when you're interviewing someone who is the person that goes home and beats their wife afterwards.
Right.
I mean, I truly have had someone tell me after interviewing like a really sensitive poet, I've had somebody say, I know this person. I'm at the school where they teach, and they seduce their students or they beat their wife, and you just never know.
Well, these guys that I grew up, the guys like my father, they wouldn't do that. I mean, sexual abuse was non-existent in Hell's Kitchen. If they found out you did that, they'd fry you. I mean, there was one drug dealer growing up as a kid in Hell's Kitchen, and somebody put him on the roof of a building and put 3 bullets in his chest and killed his dog. So that was alien. Physical violence was not... did not translate into other forms of violence. They were very much of the moment men. If that moment they were hot tempered and that moment you had ticked them off, the only reaction they knew was to hit you, to come at you. And that's it. They saw nothing wrong with that. And the men that exist like that today still see nothing wrong with that. They're very comfortable. And they're very gentlemanly. I mean, they would pull a chair out for a woman. If you didn't hold a door up for a woman, I would get slapped. They had their own sort of bizarre manners.
One last question. You've
sure.
gotten out of that world, you know what I mean, and that mentality. What about friends who you grew up with?
Well, you know, my grammar school class at Sacred Heart, I believe that as of last count, I finished grammar school with 32 boys. 20 are either dead or in prison. So
there
wasn't very much... we weren't on the fast track to the Ivy League. But the ones that made it have done okay. The ones that, you know, I mean, if you can come out of there, you know, the rest of life, I mean, it's hard, but it's not as hard as what you've seen. And you can handle yourself. If you can get through that kind of a life, and a lot of us did. One is an assistant district attorney. Another is a social worker in the Bronx helping kids. So once you can get through that situation, I think you might not have a lot of great qualities, but there's something to you. There's something to you because you've survived something that very few people have survived.
Lorenzo, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Lorenzo Carcaterra is the author of the new memoir, A Safe Place. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Thomas Hoving says he not only had to be a gifted connoisseur, a patient diplomat, and a deft fundraiser, but he also had to be a gunslinger, an accomplice smuggler, and toady. Coming up, we talk with Hoving about his decade at the Met. And Maureen Carrigan tells us about one performer who is not appearing at the inauguration festivities, but should be. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Another standoff has developed between Iraq and the United Nations over weapons inspection flights. UN officials say Iraq has failed to provide adequate assurance that UN planes will be safe if they fly over the country. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Iraq and the UN have been at odds since last week over whether the UN commission overseeing the destruction of Iraq's weapons should be allowed to fly its own planes inside the country. Iraqi officials have said repeatedly that the planes may fly, but that they can't guarantee their safety given the presence of hostile Allied aircraft in the area. Today, President Bush warned Iraq that it had until 4 o'clock Eastern time to change its position or it would face unspecified consequences. Shortly before the deadline passed, Iraqi officials sent a response to the commission in Baghdad, but a spokesman for the commission said the response was unsatisfactory. He said the commission would again apply for flight clearance this weekend, giving Iraq another chance to reverse itself. But with the deadline having passed, there remains a possibility that Allied officials could launch another airstrike against Iraq. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The United States has ordered a naval blockade along the coast of Haiti to stop the feared exodus of refugees when President-elect Clinton is sworn in. Clinton had pledged to reverse the Bush administration's policy of automatically repatriating all Haitians without asylum hearings. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Yesterday, President-elect Bill Clinton made a direct appeal to Haitians to stay put, Haitians whose hopes he raised during his campaign. Today, additional ships are moving to form a barricade off the coast. Clinton spokesman George Stephanopoulos said the president-elect was involved in the decision. It's a contingency plan, he said, worked out with the Navy and the Coast Guard in the event of a mass exodus. Coast Guard officials say the overriding purpose is to prevent the loss of life at sea. 900 Haitians have been intercepted this year already. An estimated 1,400 boats are in the water, ready to make the 600-mile trip, and the Coast Guard estimates another 200 are under construction. Clinton said yesterday he still thinks the Bush policy of forced repatriation without hearings should be changed, but it can't be done on a dime, he said, on January 20th. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
An anti-gay law in Colorado will not take effect, at least for now. A district judge has blocked the law until an appeal can be filed. Colorado voters approved the amendment in November. It prohibits the state and local governments from passing laws that protect homosexuals from discrimination. The law also nullifies gay rights laws in Boulder, Aspen, and Denver. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining 3 points to close at 3271.12. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. International mediators Cyrus Vance and Lord David Owen arrived in Croatia today for talks on their proposal to end Bosnia's civil war. The plan would divide Bosnia into 10 provinces. The meeting comes after the main Geneva talks were suspended to give Bosnia's Serb leader more time to seek approval from other Serb politicians. Bosnian Serbs had wanted to carve out their own separate republic. Russia's nuclear energy program will continue to grow, despite a number of minor incidents at nuclear power stations since the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. The head of the Nuclear Energy Ministry, Alexander Lapshin, held a news conference in Moscow today. Lapshin said Russia will complete 3 new reactors by 1995. He said the department has completely remodeled the parts that caused the Chernobyl accident. A Paraguayan judge today ordered the detention of former Paraguayan dictator Alfredo Stroessner, who's been in exile in Brazil ever since he was overthrown 4 years ago. NPR's David Wellner reports from Rio de Janeiro.
The order for Strosser's detention was based on documents that recently surfaced, which implicate the former strongman in the murder of two rural workers in the mid-1970s. A related arrest warrant was issued for the general who headed army intelligence under Stroessner. Political commentators in the Paraguayan capital of Asunción said today that the order to capture Stroessner is linked to a political fight going on over the presidential succession. Both the military and Paraguayan President General Andrés Rodríguez, who overthrew Stroessner, opposed the recent nomination of a former Stroessner ally to be the ruling Colorado Party's presidential candidate. The documents incriminating Stroessner were leaked to a former political prisoner. It's not clear yet, though, whether Paraguay will be able to extradite Stroessner from Brazil. I'm David Walnut in Rio de Janeiro.
Songwriter Sammy Kahn died today at age 79. Kahn wrote popular tunes like High Hopes and Let It Snow. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Thomas Hoving, visionary or schlockmeister? The controversy continues, sparked by his new book, Making the Mummies Dance, a memoir about his decade as director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Hoving's ambition was to blow the dust off the museum and make it into a people's cultural paradise. He opened a gift shop and brought in blockbuster shows like King Tut, and that brought in the crowds in unprecedented numbers. He expanded the museum. He bought new works with money he raised by selling off old ones. His sales and acquisitions were controversial. Hoving left the museum in 1977. During most of the 80s, he edited Connoisseur magazine. When Hoving came to the Met, he saw himself as the new guard. He told me he wanted to get rid of the old guard, particularly some of the trustees.
Well, they talked rather like this, you know. And they didn't like the madding herd, and they didn't like primitive art, and they thought that contemporary art would best be perhaps burned.
Like that. Until I got there, you did not have a department of contemporary painting and sculpture.
Why not?
Beats me. And no one was allowed, a living artist was not allowed to show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And the idea that this great encyclopedia, the only one on earth that has 50 centuries of something, of every civilization, did not have living people. You had to die before you got in there. Seemed to me so stultifying that we did change it, and we began to show one-man shows of living artists, and it was marvelous.
How did you change it?
Simply said, we're going to have a department of contemporary, and if you have contemporary, the chances are somebody's going to be alive. And one of the shows we did was Francis Bacon, and he actually came in and arranged the exhibition himself. And that was stunning to watch what an artist does with his own works. Totally different from what an exhibitor or a curator would have done. Completely different.
One of the first contemporary paintings that you showed at the Met when you were there was James Rosenquist's F-111. Why was it so controversial?
I can't figure it. Look at it today. It's a huge pop art painting, and it's got part of the F-111 jet fighter. It's got a baby doll under a hair dryer, and it's got some spaghetti rolling around on the floor. I mean, it's one of these kinetic images that Jim Rosenquist did then very well, still does. And I had made the mistake of exhibiting it as a history painting. There used to be in the academies of the 18th and 19th century categories of painting, portraiture, still life, history painting. And it was a history painting. It was a modern history painting. So I showed it in the same gallery as Jacques-Louis David's Death of Socrates. And I showed it with a large sketch of Emmanuel Leutze's Washington Crossing the Delaware. And the art critics, one of them accused me of being morally turpitudinous. And I had to go to Webster's, frankly, to find out what turpitudinous meant. It means you have a low, sleazy, and disgusting lifestyle or something. And I was morally incorrect because I showed this picture next to Jacques-Louis David. And they got really annoyed because of that.
Did you
like
the painting?
People got very annoyed. I adored the painting. I still do. I tried to get it for the Met. Robert Skull and his wife Ethel owned it, and they promised me they would give it. They didn't. They promised me they would give the great Andy Warhol Ethel Skull 36 times, and guess what? They walked out. They chintzed.
Now, why do I think that you're speaking of these people differently now than you spoke of them or to them when you were the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art?
Well, when I was facing Nelson Rockefeller, I kissed his feet, I suckled his fingers, I said, sir, I was a toady. Now, occasionally, I would come right to grips with some of these people, although I did, God knows, flatter them and try to make them very happy. I would tell them, you're wrong on this, or, you know, we're not going to do that. So I did have a couple of times when, more than a couple, when I would get into fracases with potential donors. Well, they tried to throw me out. The board tried to oust me three times for good reason. They should have probably, but they didn't. So it was both. I mean, I toadied sometimes and then would hit them in the face the other.
How do you think the arts are helped and or hurt by their dependence on wealthy benefactors? And I'm thinking here particularly of institutions.
I would say that in the long pull, art and money doesn't mix. And art should be art, and money is something else. But trying to better yourself in buying great art or get a social status by it or buy your way into it, it doesn't really work. The passion has to be there. But I found enough people who were really rich, who were powerful, but also had an absolute craving and a knowledge in great art, and I got along very well with them.
Were you ever picky about who you took money from? Would you take it from anybody who'd give it?
No, we were quite selective about it, and the tobacco, we had one brush with Philip Morris for a collection, Treasures of the Great High Foundation, which are the American Indian things that were up in 158th Street. It's about to go down to the Smithsonian now. You know, it's going to be a big American Indian Museum on the Mall. It was that collection. It had not been shown. We showed extraordinary pieces from this huge collection. And we got a grant from Philip Morris, and I looked at the proofs of the catalog. And there, the chairman of Philip Morris had written and signed, and he had a paragraph starting to go, I said, because of our deep affection for the reverence that American Indians held for tobacco. So I called him and said, hold it. You know, what is this? It's a religious experience. You can't do that. So the guy said, you know, we're going to take our money away. I said, take your money away. Well, they didn't, but that paragraph was expunged, and we never dealt with the cigarette guys anymore.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Hoving, former director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and author of a book about his tenure there called Making the Mummies Dance. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thomas Hoving is my guest, former director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and author of the new book, Making the Mummies Dance. In your book, Making the Mummies Dance, you say that to be effective and to survive as director, you had to be part gunslinger, part ward healer, legal fixer, accomplice, smuggler, anarchist, and toady. I think we got to the toady part that you were referring to.
Right.
Let's get to the part of your job description that you describe as accomplice smuggler.
Well, in the days before 1971 in the art business, there were no rules. There was no UNESCO treaty trying to stop the outrageous flow of smuggled treasures from Turkey, Greece, Italy. You bought an antiquity because it was beautiful. And you didn't have to have papers for provenance, whether it came from this or that collection. Everybody knew it was dug up 3 months before. The mud was virtually still fresh on the stuff. And it cost whatever it cost. You said, great, and buy it. Then it became apparent in 1970 when UNESCO was beginning to draft its treaty that many nations have signed, America has, that the old era of looking the other way or laughing about it was gone. And so I, as director, became part of the drafting team on UNESCO treaty because I knew hey, it's over. So don't try to keep the past alive. Now you got to be respectful of what did this thing have as a history. And we began to do that rather sharply, and the Mets' dealings with known hot pieces began to diminish sharply after about 1971. And they don't do it at all today. Virtually no museum does. Well, there are few in the United States. It's still there.
You've said that you've used subterfuge in buying works, and one example you give is when you were buying the Velazquez painting. You organized what you described as a disinformation campaign. You say, we spread rumors around like the disinformation section of the KGB.
And probably we did a better job. There are several copies of the great painting Juan de Pareja. There's one at the Hispanic Society in New York, which is definitely a copy of about 50, 100 years later. We put out rumors that this was the real one, and the one coming up for auction must have been one of the copies. And people believed it, because you're looking at a painting for $5 million, you don't want any doubts.
How'd you spread that rumor?
Oh, we just told various people that I know go to nothing but cocktail parties and dinner parties and tell their host and hostess what they know. And we saw to it that they knew, and the word spread like wildfire. Wildfire.
No. What is the morality of spreading lies about art?
Well, it's part of the business. It has no morality whatsoever. It just happens to be a technique that, since it wasn't published, it was rumors, it was an opinion. So what? You know, it was part of, it's smoke screening.
One of the things that you are pretty famous for in the art world is being one of the forces behind the blockbuster show. You didn't invent the blockbuster show, but you certainly popularized it and... you were one of the people kind of responsible for its spread. Is that the right? Popularity?
Well,
is it?
We one focused it. The whole point of blockbusters at the Met was to bring the public something they could never see on their own or have a very hard time seeing. I mean, it's not everybody can get on a plane and go to the Hermitage for a long weekend or go to Cairo for 2 days and come back after seeing King Tut. So we wanted to bring to people things that, one, they could not see. Two, they didn't even know was art. For example, Scythian art. These are the nomad tribes of the Ukraine who populated that part of what was then the Soviet Union during the 6th and 5th century B.C. And not a single one of their glorious works of art had ever been seen outside the Soviet Union because Peter the Great had passed a law saying it should not be moved. Or sold or allowed out. So nobody knew about it. And it's art that is equivalent to the greatest Greek and Hellenistic art. And we showed that. We did not do paintings from the Hermitage because we have Rembrandts, we have Poussins, we have all that. And we decided to exchange our old masters for something that nobody even knew about. So part of it was to bring to people through a temporary exhibition things that you could never have in the permanent collection. That was the main reason. We also marketed these shows pretty well. We were the first ones that ever ran ads. We were the first ones that ever had radio and television ads and people talking about it. We were also the first ever to have a corporation fund one of these things. And they then picked up advertising campaigns, and that had a further impact upon the word getting out. So in a sense, we took what existed, great art shows had been for some time, and simply put them into the contemporary mode. And it worked wonders. I think there were some lovely ones and there were some awful ones. I think right now the age of the blockbuster is a dinosaur. I think it's dead, and I think they should be given the last rites.
Why do you think it's dead now?
Well, they're not really blockbusters anymore. They say they are. There'll be a great show of Caravaggio in which there are three Caravaggios and the rest are followers. And you can't afford... The point is that art prices have risen to such ridiculously astronomical heights that nobody can afford the cost of insurance and other things to bring the works of, you name it, into one place anymore. It's virtually impossible to do. And even the Matisse show, that may be the last of these hugely expensive things because people are unwilling to lend anymore. And it's too costly. I mean, that show is, what, $6 to $8 million, something like that. That's amazing. $6 to $8 million, my goodness. So I think probably there are other things that can be done instead of the standard blockbuster. They're getting boring.
Thomas Oving, one last question. The health of the art world. What's your assessment?
Well, if they can get over the political and religious right attack on all art, not just a couple of performance artists or so, but all art. If they can get over this period of creeping iconoclasm and do it courageously, I think things will be fine. I happen to believe that the recession has been healthy for the arts because it got some of the money-only superficial people out of it, and I think that's good. I think the auction houses were getting to be, it's just sides of beef. They were selling, you know, pork belly futures. And I think that that has helped because the people have stuck with it, are looking at it with affection rather than just, what do you think that's worth? How much did that go for? What did that do at the sale? You know, which is all destructive to art. So I think it's generally healthy, but they got to solve the censorship thing. Our greatest exportable product in America today is our freedom of our arts. We sell more of that abroad than we do cars and anything else.
When you say arts, you're including popular culture, movies,
I
television,
mean popular
records.
Culture, that's art. I mean, to me, the film, Hollywood even, is the fine art of today. Crafts is the fine art of today. And some of the fine art of today is going to be looked upon as, oh, my God, money stuff. You know, pork belly futures.
Thomas Hoving is the former director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. His new memoir is Making the Mummies Dance. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have news of the virtual U.S. blockade of Haiti today. It's not really a naval blockade, but the Coast Guard has set up ships around the island trying to keep Haitians from setting sail for the U.S., trying to seek refuge here, trying to keep them in. Also today, we'll have Mara Liasson's report on Senator Al Gore and how he foresees his role as vice president to Bill Clinton. The latest on the U.S. and Iraq over ultimatums and flights over the south of Iraq. And also, remember Bill Clinton's very active New Year's Day when he golfed, ran, biked, heard about infrastructure? Our own Bob Garfield will try to run through the Clinton routine today in the Clintathlon.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Maureen Corrigan lives in Washington, D.C., and she's watching the city whip itself into an Inauguration Week frenzy. The festivities begin Sunday with a concert at the Lincoln Memorial, featuring hundreds of big-name performers, everyone from Tony Bennett to Little Richard. Although performance artist Pat Alesko will also be around this weekend, she wasn't asked to be part of the illustrious lineup. Maureen says that's because Alesko would steal the show.
A bunch of friends are camping out on my living room floor next week. They all want to be here for the inauguration, even though they won't be able to see a thing. All the bleacher seats along the parade route are reserved. So is every patch of grass within 5 miles of the swearing-in ceremony. I know what's going to happen on Wednesday. We'll go downtown, get jostled in that Whitman-esque mob just long enough to feel like we're a part of history, and then we'll go back to my house and watch those marching Elvis impersonators on TV. But before we leave, I want to take my friends over to the National Museum of Women in the Arts. It's just a couple of blocks from the White House, and right now it's presenting an exhibit of the work of performance artist Pat Alesko. Alesko is a professional court jester who likes to tweak the powers that be, what she calls the ruling crass. Generally, I condemn performance artists to the same circle of hell as mimes and anybody who sings Leonard Cohen songs. But Alesko is different. She's not esoteric. Her brand of political satire is a cross between the giddy, yippy agitprop of an Abbie Hoffman and the loopy sexiness of a Carmen Miranda. The humor in most of Alesko's pieces arises out of elaborate verbal and visual puns. Listen to this piece about JFK's visit to Berlin, entitled Not a Petty Slight.
When Kennedy came to the city shortly after the wall was built, he spoke the words, Ich bin ein Berliner, which brought down the house for a number of reasons. First of all, it was the first time an American president had wrapped his tongue around a foreign language, and second of all, it was wrong. In his enthusiasm for accessing his solidarity with the West Berliners, he blundered. In German, to state a person is something, a profession, an inhabitant, you do so without the indefinite article. Ich bin Berliner. Ein Berliner is a jam-filled donut, the kind that when you take a bite, it bleeds. So there on that cold morning, for all the world to hear, was our president's Jack's genuine gesture becoming a joke off to the assembled masses. Ich bin ein Berliner. I am a donut.
You've got to understand that as Alesko is talking, she's also building and then eating her way through a Berlin Wall constructed out of jelly donuts. The costumes Padalecki wears in her video performances are outrageous. They're made of fabric and foam, and some are even equipped with light bulbs and fans that make them pulsate. One of Alesko's ongoing targets is the patriarchy. It's inspired such costume creations as Charles Patless, a giant inflatable muscle-bound suit, and also Mike Hammer and Tom Sawyer. They're the anthropomorphic stars of a piece called Tool Jest, in which Alesko pokes fun at the macho mystique of construction workers. My favorite costume is Utter Delight. It's a suit composed entirely of inflatable breasts, and it lampoons one of mankind's eternal fixations. On the morning I toured the Alesko exhibit, this costume was surrounded by Washington matrons, giggling like a pack of grammar school girls. Come to think of it, maybe Hillary should sneak out of the inauguration and into the Padalecki exhibit for a couple of hours. After all the bashing she's taken for not fitting patriarchy's first lady image, she could probably use a few laughs.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Padalecki's exhibit at the National Museum of Women in the Arts runs through March 7th. She performs tomorrow afternoon at the Gunston Art Center in Arlington, Virginia. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Special thanks to our intern, Stephanie Baum, who leaves us today. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the first former Black Panther in the U.S. Congress. We talk with Bobby Rush, congressman from Chicago. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.